What was going on in 1966? Well, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm sober by the grace of God and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I say by the grace of God, I mean it just that way. I have blackouts, bad, long-term blackouts when I drink. But I drank every day. My mother was a periodic alcoholic. She only drank beer. I could not believe you could be an alcoholic on beer. I didn't think beer was anything other than a beverage. In Atlanta, when I started drinking beer, it was 6% alcohol. Moved to Ohio, and it was 3.2. That's like bathwater. I don't know. That was nothing. I liked whiskey. That's what I really wanted to drink. And I had some fellas in high school that used to put the pints in the glove compartment, and it'd get hot. So when you took that gulp, it was like an explosion, and your whole body came alive, and your fingers and toes curled. And I said, I like that. That's for me. And I had a hollow leg. I drove many a Georgia Tech football player home throwing up out the window, and I felt sober as a judge. Like I said, I didn't feel drunk, but I get blackouts. When I was 25 years old, I went for a, went out telling my family I was going to get a loaf of bread. Of course, I was really going to the bar. I'm a bar drinker. I like bars a lot. I didn't like to sit in the closet and drink. I didn't want to be in my kitchen or club or drinking. I like bars. I like the excitement. I like the people. I like everything about them. So when I'm 25 and I'm going out for a loaf of bread, I blink a little bit, and I'm under a light, and a cop is shining his light in my face. And he's saying, are you okay? And I could come out of a blackout sober as talking as you'd think. I would never had a drink. And I said, I think I'm lost. And he said, I think you must be. I said, where am I? He said, Evanston. I said, Evanston what? He said, right outside of Chicago, Evanston, Illinois. I've been drinking in Atlanta. Had no idea, no idea. I could track my way because of the checks I wrote or the ATMs I hit, but other than that, I didn't know. I have no idea how long I was gone. I only know that when I finally called my family, I said what I always said. My husband's driving me crazy, and you gotta help me. And my mother said, you just come right home and we'll get you to a doctor. And I said, sounds good to me. And I went home, and she took me to a doctor, and I got some wonderful medication. And I found out I could drink on medication and not get the shakes, because I was bad for shaking. And I also liked the other medication that would get me up and maybe allow to work all day, get my kids done. I had three kids. Get my house clean, one to clean house, one to my life to be as normal and traditional as possible, as long as I could get a babysitter at night and hit the bars. My husband was very fortunate to get into the computer programs in Atlanta in the very beginning. This was around 63, I guess. Computers just came out to Georgia Tech. We had more money than you could even imagine, and we didn't know what we were doing. Young, dumb, and numb. It was pitiful. What we had and what we blew. He drank like I did, and it didn't seem fair that he could drink and keep on drinking and I couldn't. He'd go to sleep maybe in a corner or something. Me, it gave me energy. I could dance all night. I could be ready to get up with the kids in the morning. Everything was going good. So after that terrible experience of that blackout, I got home. I'm not going to not drink as much, but I won't run around as much. So at 27, I divorced him, got rid of my problem, kept on drinking. I went to I thought I was going to live high on the hog. I was getting child support money. I mean, how good could that be? I didn't have to have a job, had child support. And I thought that I'd be fine, that'd take me okay. This one night, I spent the last of my child support money on a Saturday night, I remember, that I said I'd never, never, never do, ever. I would never touch that money. Well, I did. I was in an all-night place. We had after hours, because the bars would close like at 2 or so. Then you could go to an all-night place and buy booze in the hotels next door. So I got a bottle and went next door. I don't remember anything after that much. I vaguely remember, I think, getting my car. I just, there's a flash And then the next thing I remember is a policeman in front of me was very angry. And he said I had to quit spelling. The only thing I could think of was that he asked me to spell my last name, and I never quit spelling. I just kept going. He kept saying, quit spelling, quit spelling. I kept hearing myself and thinking, shut up, quit spelling. But I couldn't. I said, well, drive me home. Now, I'd been saying that to cops for 10 years. Drive me home, and they would. Or they'd say, you be a good little girl, and you go right home. I'd stone down on my door, and I'd drive home, and I usually made it okay. So this night, he said, lady, you're not going home. Well, I don't remember much after that. I don't remember getting in the paddy wagon. I don't remember getting booked. I remember telling them I was not taking a breathalyzer, period. And they didn't argue with me. I don't remember any of that. I don't remember the next day, except one of the nurses said, do you have seizures? And I said, well, I don't know. I don't know. And she said, well, I'm worried about you because you don't look well. I don't know when I got out. I don't know how that happened. I remember being taken home and put in my bedroom and told to shut up and lay down. I remember that part. I laid there, and it's weird. Sometimes I don't like talking about it, but I popped out of my body. I was on the ceiling watching myself. That looks pretty strange. And I had this voice telepathically, I guess, saying, you want to come on in to the white light, or do you want to go back? And I said, I got three kids. I've got to go back. And so, okay. And I sat up in the bed, back in my body. But there was a voice inside of me. I said, I'm going to change. I'm going to do things different. And this voice, very male voice, very clear, said, you're a liar and we don't trust you. I thought, that didn't sound very angelic. I mean, I've had this magical experience, this spiritual experience. How could you talk to me in that tone of voice and like that? And I said, well, I am. And so I'm trying to think what I'm going to do to prove to this voice that I could be trusted. And all I could come up with, I'm going to call my mother and tell her I'm an alcoholic. Because my mother being an alcoholic and trying to get sober, I had had a few words with her about her drinking. And if there's one person I did not want her to know that I drank, was my mother. So I called her. I said, mother, I'm an alcoholic. And she said, call AA. And I said, oh, I don't need to do that. I'm just going to take care of it. She said, Ann, call AA. I said, I can't do that. I can't go to meetings. I live too far away. It's too far. You know, I don't have any money. She said, Ann, call AA. That wasn't going to get around her. So, okay, I called AA from, like somebody said, we had the Yellow Pages. I had the Yellow Pages. I called AA. And it was the NABA Club in Atlanta, if you're familiar with Northside Alcohol Benevolent Association. They had just built a beautiful building in September, and this was March. So it was brand new. It was lovely. I didn't know the difference between a meeting and a club. I thought I knew about AA. I didn't know nothing. Just what I would read to her, what she needed to know, how she needed to do it, et cetera, but I didn't know anything about it. So some people came over and picked me up and took me to NABA Club. Now, while I was doing all that, my shakes, stammering, that whole thing had stopped. I wasn't in withdrawal at all. So I went in and I sat me down. They got me honey and orange juice with shaved ice. That was the typical get sober drug back then. That's what they gave you. The sugar in the drink would help replace the sugar from the booze. So I got all excited about telling this guy that I was talking to about this spiritual experience. And he said, honey, don't tell anybody that stuff. And I said, why not? He said, they'll think you're nuts. And they'll lock you up. He said, if it's true, you've had a spiritual experience, you will never forget it in your life, and your life will be changed forever. If it's not, if it's hallucination, which it could have been, he said, 6 weeks, you won't remember it. If it was a dream, he said, next week, you won't know it. He said, so just figure, it's okay. You're where you're supposed to be now. And some guy came in, he was a pharmacist in recovery, and he said, you look like a pill taker, are you? And he said, again, do you have seizures? I said, I don't think so. And he said, well, I want you to go to CVS or to a drugstore, and I want you to get some vitamins. I want you to get C, B12, He said, get you three or four. He said, because you're used to taking pills when you want to get fixed. And he said, I want you to take those when you want to kill somebody, when you want to drink, when you want to run away, whatever. Take a vitamin, and you'll feel better. I believed him. I had no... Okay, got little vitamins. I was taking vitamins, getting healthier by the minute. I got so active. I loved NABA so much. I would do anything, absolutely anything. I got on the list to speak and all like that. And I didn't like women, I'm sorry. Never did like women in the programs. Loved the men and hung with the men. They listened, you know. They were so kind, and women were not kind. You know, they'd say, come to the meetings. Shut up, come to the meetings. One of the ladies in there I learned to love a lot. She'd say, count yourself again, you ain't so many. Because every time I'd say I, she'd say, count yourself again. That I ain't so many. She came to me and she said, we've decided we want you to come to share your story. Okay, and so it's car full of people. We're going to, where are we going? You just come tell. When we tell you to talk, you talk. When we tell you to shut up, shut up. And so we went. This is from Atlanta. They took me to Milledgeville, Georgia. That's where the state hospital is. And my first talk was at Milledgeville, Georgia. And I spoke, and I spoke, and I spoke, and I spoke. And when we got back in the car, I said, how'd they do? And they said, we have something to tell you. I said, what? They said, when we say talk, it's in a general way what you used to be like, what happened, and what you're like now. Dave's dates, places have no places. We're trying to identify. That's all. We don't need to know what you did. You're not the worst drunk that ever was. I tried to be the worst drunk. You know, you're not the saint. Forget that. You got to get honest. Well, I didn't know what honesty meant. I really didn't. I said I was young, I was dumb, and I was numb all my life. I was an only child. My mother was alcoholic, and she drank and laid in the bed a lot. So I was by myself. Didn't relate to people. We moved all over the country. I was either the northern kid with a southern accent or the southern kid with a northern accent. We moved all over. Finally, from Atlanta, this guy was driving around to meetings, and he carried the Bible with him and the big book, and he knew the program. I mean, he knew page this and page that, and this is what it says, and this is where, oh, you know, and this is how you do the steps. And I was just, whoa, wow, this guy's going to help me stay sober. We're going to be Mr. and Mrs. AA. How nice. You know, we'll just go to all the meetings, and I got a ride and everything. So actually, we got married, of course, 6 months after I got sober. I believed him. I believed him completely. I thought God sent him to me. I had spiritual experience. The Lord was in my side, and everything was okay. It took me 4 years to never did get sober. He'd been drinking the whole time. He was a traveling salesman. He left on Monday night. He stayed having a good time until Friday. And then he came home, went to the meeting. I found that out. I couldn't believe it. I felt so betrayed. And I thought, why didn't you guys know? Nobody would talk about it. Anyway, I got divorced. But I got to be known for doing all this AA work. So I did stay with him until we got to Tampa. He got transferred to Tampa and got married, and I got divorced in Tampa. But my name, I'd been sober in 5 or 6 or 7 years by that time, and everybody knew that as a female. They needed females in the program because there weren't many, and those that were wouldn't talk. You know, they wouldn't tell their story in front of people. Everything was very quiet. I especially wasn't going to tell anything spiritual because I knew that labeled me as a nut. I didn't want to be labeled as a nut. So I didn't say any of that. I just tried to stay sober and go to meetings and help other alcoholics. The federal money came in for treatment programs, and the federal government, through the University of South Florida, was looking for recovering female alcoholics to work in the field. They wanted to know what the blood alcohol level should be in legislature for when they do the BAC, when the breathalyzers came in. So we did. We stopped cars and we did all that. And we recommended, as a group of us, from 3333. I was a member of 3333 at that time. And we'd all signed up for these federal programs. And so they, we said we thought that a BAC of a 0.08 would be reasonable. 05 was too small, 15 was too big. They went with 15 that first year, and they found out how many people cannot drive a car with a blood alcohol level of 0.15. So research proved that, and they went with it with that. And then we were working on getting the DUI school going. Well, our group, again, we were all recovering people. We all agreed to work in the fellowship, in the program. I mean, not in the fellowship. We were in the fellowship, but we didn't count that. I've never counted working in the field and my personal program as the same thing. They're very different. If those of you who work, I know some of you work in the field, you know you got to keep that separate. Anyway, we got the money and we started doing that. And we were doing the assessment, the referrals. We were doing the whole thing. And the government said, that's too much power for one group. Said, okay. So they split us all up. Now, I had been working with people for a long time, and I had a high school education, and that's it. I was terrified of education. I drank my way through high school. I could not take tests. I could not pass a test. I just can't cut it. Well, I can't keep working in the programs and become an alcohol counselor if I didn't have some education. So, bite the bullet, I figure out, what am I gonna do? Took the tests over at USF, could not pass them. And they had some counselors that said, you know, adults who come back to school typically have too much test anxiety to be able to do well in school. What we're gonna recommend, you go over to the Department of Psychology and get hypnotized. I'll do anything, I don't know. I don't know what else to do. I read the books, I think I can answer the questions. I sit down and my mind goes totally blank. They said, well, go get hypnotized and see what happens. So I did. I got a C in math. I was astonished. I was so happy. I cannot begin to tell you. That was better than an A plus on anything I had ever done, that I could get through a mathematical questionnaire of any kind. I could see the paper. So I was an advocate if I needed hypnotism or I needed to get control of my brain. They talked to me about not being able to control my thinking. And they were right. I didn't know how. I didn't know what the problem was, but I didn't know how to control my thinking. I couldn't control my breathing. I hyperventilated all the time. Heavy anxiety. You know, I'd just about pass out from being anxious. But I didn't know that's what was going on. I took some art classes one time, and a guy said that I was taking art from, because they told me in AA, you need to get some creative outlets. You know, we just get too stuffed with stuff. Go take a creative outlet of some kind. I don't care what you do. Do something creative. So I decided to take a painting class. And he'd say, go paint a tree. So I'd go paint a tree trunk brown, green leaves, blue sky, here. That's not a tree. What do you mean that's not a tree? Go look at the tree. I'd go out and look at the tree. Brown, green, blue, here. No. He said, look at the colors. I said, I did. It's brown. That's not the colors of a tree. Oh, I went out, I looked at that tree trunk and I began to see a multitude of colors. There was pinks and there was yellows and there was browns and there was blues. And I'm like, wow, where have I been all my life? I've never seen a tree. And I got all excited about that. And that began to give me some idea. I was willing to be honest, I just couldn't be. And I could see then why, because I couldn't perceive things. I'd never gotten educated in a way that was healthy for me. You know, my mom did the best she could, but she couldn't stay sober. It wasn't her fault, she just couldn't. She had a change of life baby after I got sober, and they put her back on pills. She'd been sober 8 years. And she got a hold of those pills, and she was off and running again. I went up to Ohio because I'd been sober. I was going to give a talk. And she was scared to death I was going to tell her story. I said, I am not here to tell your story. I don't know your story. I'm telling my story. Well, she hid in the kitchen, and I gave my little talk. And she said, oh, that was so good. She said, but let me tell you something. I said, what? She said, I had 8 years. And she said, I thought because I could have been slipping and sliding in and out, I could drink a little and get sober again. She said, you can lose your want to. She said, if you lose your want to, that's terrible. She said, I've lost my want to. I don't want to get sober anymore, but I can't get sober anymore. And she didn't mean she couldn't drink anymore or not drink. She didn't want to do the work that it took, and she couldn't drink, and she couldn't not drink. And she died when she was 54. She mixed alcohol and pills, and it killed her. My brother, that change of life baby she had, did the same thing, and he died at 45. I'm the only one in my generations that has been able to stay sober, and I am so grateful for that. And it's the result of the fellowship, because when I get away from the fellowship, which I have not done, I got off on church at one point in time because I wanted to know a little bit more about this spiritual stuff since I'd had that experience. And I missed people. I could see people in church, but I missed them. I couldn't feel them anymore. I wanted to be with people I could feel, that I could hear, that I understood. So I came back into AA full time. I never went away very far, but I did work in the field for, I don't know, 50 years, I guess. I didn't quit till I was 77. I've always worked in the field of addictions in one form or another. One of the reasons I did, because I felt called to. You know, say, so what's your purpose in life? My purpose in life, just because God nudged me, not because I necessarily wanted to or anything else, but God always nudged me. I could close that door and lock it, and by God, I'd get a phone call, I'd run into somebody, or somebody'd offer me something, and there would be work in the field. I've done jobs and didn't get paid hardly any. I've done a lot of jobs I didn't get paid anything for. But then I realized that if I was gonna stay working, I had a mission to make sure that we provided the very best treatment for addictions or alcoholism you could get. And we had some pretty crappy programs back then. I worked for the Mental Health Board for a while. I worked for ACTS. I've worked for every program around here. The hospitals, the psychiatrists. I've worked for most of the psychiatrists in Tampa at least once. But people didn't, they just couldn't get it if they weren't addicts and they weren't in the program. That always amazed me. I will tell you the story of the latest one. 5 years ago, I had an ophthalmologist. And I said, I hadn't told him everything. It's just, I had some trouble with my eye. And he said, well, I think you've got some problem with behind your iris. I said, okay. I said, you know, I'm alcoholic. And he put his pen down. He said, I thought you were a nice girl. I said, I am a nice girl and I am an alcoholic. But it's that kind of ignorance, even today, with all the education, with all the literature, when you stay carrying your message, you're carrying it to every person you run into. I don't care if they're a doctor, a lawyer, a preacher, whatever. When you say, I'm an alcoholic and I'm sober, that's carrying a message. And I got sober in AA, and it works. And I know that I've had to do that a lot of times with a lot of highfalutin people. I finally worked my way up. I remember. I gotta tell you this, the first job I ever had, an AA member gave me a job. He gave me a job being a file clerk. He said, your files are so messed up in your brains, you need to be a file clerk for me so you can get your thinking straight. I said, okay. So I went over there and the office manager said, that's your job description, but while you're in here, you make the coffee first thing in the morning and you empty the trash at night. I said, but I'm a file clerk. He said, yeah, but you work for me. And that dawned on me. You know, ain't what you know, it's who you know. And I had better get prepared to ask questions about what the job is. Because I would always say yes to the job and then say, and what? And they would always, no matter what I did, it seemed like, give me a quality improvement director. I hated math. I told you I couldn't pass it, didn't like it, didn't want to do it. Quality improvement directors do terrible statistical analysis. And that was my job, always. I do all the other stuff, but I also had to gather all the data and make the reports. So I thought God had a sense of humor. He really did. My God talks to me all the time. He can call me nuts, that's okay. I have a good conversation, we laugh a lot. I get nudges. I better watch a nudge, because if I don't get it the first or second time, I'll get a real painful one in my ribs. Like I said, I wanted to make programs the very best I possibly could. And I thought, this is dumb and numb thinking, if I got to be the CEO of a program, I would be important. I thought then I'd have some power. Then I'd be able to tell people what to do and how to do it. And I could really tell them. Well, there's 12 people above the CEO, and that's the board of directors. And they're people who may not know a damn thing about your program, but they have all the power and all the direction. So you gotta make peace with that at some point. I was able to be the director of a community primary care center and for 5 years. And I did have some input into what the doctors said and did. Suboxone did me in. I just couldn't go with the Suboxone doctors. I had to leave and go back to LifeStream. I worked at LifeStream, if you know, in Leesburg, Florida. I worked their clinical director for a long, long time. It's wonderful to work in the field. You get a lot of rewards, but I will tell you, when you look at your own program, it's like everybody else that stood up here today. You have to work the steps to the program to the best of your ability, as honest as you're capable of being. My honesty, I didn't know what a resentment was, I didn't know what the word meant. And they said it's a resending of an ego defeat situation. That means anytime I look bad, I'm gonna be mad about it. And I'm gonna try and blame it on somebody else. Honesty is a hallmark of our program. Takes a while. It doesn't mean you're gonna get drunk that right away, but you're not gonna get real happy right away. You can break most, you know, break the rules. You know, getting married 6 months sober was not bright, but I must have needed it because I learned a lot from it. I learned how gullible I am. I learned how I could trust most anybody for nothing. Learned I was also willing to go to any lengths to stay sober. You know, you take all these little negative experiences, I don't care what they are, and you roll them up, and then you, what kind of progress are you making? Well, as a QI director, it was always, statistically, how do I prove, how to make it progress? Are my resentments less than they used to be? I sit down, like somebody else said, annually I sit down with my sponsor. I write out, and I believe in writing. Somebody else said that. I believe you write things out, whether it's called automatic writing or it's whatever it is. If it's in your own handwriting, you seem to get it easier than it's reading a book or somebody else's. So I've already written it out. And then I look at the percentages. What percentage am I more honest than I used to be? Do I have an example of that in my life this year? And I tell my sponsor, well, I will tell you, I was not particularly honest on this day or in this something, and I will feel better. And sometimes that comes out, I don't even know that's the issue. I now live in an assisted living facility. I gave up my land and everything I own to live and be taken care of because it's easier for me. And there's some ladies there I don't like. Surprise. But every one of them, when I look across the room and I say, I don't like her, I have learned to say, what about me that I see in her don't I like? And it's so clear. I will tell you, that's the quickest way for me to take my inventory. What don't I like about that other person? Well, the one person that I particularly don't like, she's attention-getting. She talks too much. She's loud. She's assertive. Why doesn't she shut up? Now, I'm not going to say that out loud. I've learned enough to keep my mouth shut. But you know, when I have that kind of a negative thought, why would I feel about that way about somebody? She's not paying my rent. I don't have any investment in her at all. Why would that be such a strong reaction? Because I want that changed in me. I want me to be more soft-spoken. I want to be more of a listener than a talker. You know, I have learned that in this program more than anything else, because I could talk for hours, is to be able to listen and to hear what people are saying. I became a psychotherapist, and that was an absolute, had to be. And that's hard. That's as hard as math is for me, to sit there for an hour and not have an opinion on something. You know, but I had to learn it. God told me that I had to learn it. I learned it. I had to learn how to meditate. Strange word, meditate. Well, if you can't breathe right, you can't meditate right. So I was taught how to breathe. You know, you have to breathe deeply. You have to let go. And that let go and let God was what told me whether I was doing it right or not. Because if I can't let go and let God, it's not going to get down into my heart. You know, a lot of that's physiology. It's just, that's the way it is. Not good, not bad, just is. But I have found that people, just like you people, just like we heard today, people have answers, they're ready to help. All you got to do is ask. I belong to the heavy hitters group. My home group is a women's group, closed women's group. Ha ha. They got me after all. And I loves them. And we have a good time. We have a book club on Monday nights, and our Saturday morning is great. And if you haven't been up to Heavy Hitters on Bell Avenue, please do. I was a member of their Tuesday group for a year, and then their Thursday group, that was the first three steps, and then the other one was for the mixed group. And then on Fridays, we have a speaker meeting, and Saturdays is our women's group. People say, you've been sober so long, you probably don't even remember what it was like drinking. Well, in the last 5 years, I've had a drunk dream. I thought I got over all that eventually. About every 5 years, I'll have a drunk dream that reminds me right down to my toes what drinking was like. I don't know if any of you have ever had any. First time you ever have a drunk dream, might scare you to death. Did me. I did not like that feeling at all. And I called my sponsor. I said, well, you know, what do I need to know about that? And she said, what do you think you need to know about that? I said, I'm glad I'm not drinking. She said, that's enough. I'm grateful for sobriety. I'm grateful I'm sober. I was really tickled that Dominic came up. My grandson came up for my anniversary last year. And when he asked me if I wouldn't mind coming up here, I was excited because he came up from Tampa, picked me up, and drove me down here. Reminded me of all the good AA I had when I drove around with other people, because what you're talking about in the car sometimes is the very best meeting you can have. You know, we drive all over the country, but driving up here with him was very helpful, and I've enjoyed meeting all of you people. You're wonderful. He's lucky to have these kinds of groups up here. We're lucky in Hernando County to have our groups. But, you know, if you're used to just coming to the same old meetings, shake yourself up a little bit. Go to a different meeting. Hear something from somebody else sometime. We hear the same words, but we don't hear the same heart. And it can come across. I believe God speaks through people. I think that's God's voice. I'm surprised sometimes in a meeting, 30 people go around, talk. All of a sudden, one person will say something, and it will be like headlines to me in my head. And it will be like, oh, wow, I needed to hear that. It'll be something simple. It might be let go and let God, or one of the cliches, or just something. And it's like, that's God's message for me. And you know, that's what can make it, one day at a time exciting. That's what can make the 12th step exciting. I thought a spiritual experience was probably the best thing. I mean, I figured I'd done the first three steps right there with that experience. This book was really wise to change that to an awakening, not an experience. An experience is just an event. Doesn't really have much meaning, good or bad. I know after I decided, I thought maybe it would be, I wanted another experience. I went over to Casadega and took the spiritualist course over there to become a spiritualist. That didn't do me any good. I went to a lot of churches. I've studied a lot of religions. Not for me. AA is really the only thing that touches my heart and my life. But haven't had any more of those out-of-body experiences. That might be a good thing. But I have had an awakening of gratitude. An attitude of gratitude is the most important thing in my life. Somebody else said, start talking. What am I grateful for today? I had somebody told me, and I tell my people I sponsor, first thing you do every day is you look in the mirror, you say you're grateful to be sober, and you wash your face. That's it. Start your day right. Get your face washed. When you see your sober face there, know that's what you've got riding on this day, a sober face and gratitude to God. Doesn't have to be any more complicated than that. You don't have to get good. In fact, I told a guy when I first came in, I said, I came here to get sober. I didn't want to get good. You know, that just wasn't a part of it. I was having a good time. But it just goes with the territory if you want to have a clean conscience and admire yourself. Like he said, he wore the suit out of respect. You respect this program. You know, it shows. It shows when you respect what's going on here. It shows how you treat each other and how you treat the people that did all this work. I mean, this was a lot of work. This just didn't happen. You know, you pick up the trash, for crying out loud. That's what I did. You know, you pick up the trash, you drive somebody else to a meeting. That money that I didn't have at that first meeting I went to and I shared, I was broke. Somebody put my rent money in my hand when I left that meeting. And I said, I'll pay you back. He said, no, you pay it forward, you don't pay it back. You do it for somebody else. That's the point of this program. You give it away so you can keep it. And that has always meant a lot to me. Give it away if you can, however you can, however you visualize it or talk about your own self, give it away. It's a very respectful thing to do. Thank you for being here and for sharing everything with me. I appreciate it.